United Kingdom. Across the Atlantic Ocean is my best friend in the entire world, like the whole world. Like there's like over 7 billion people on this planet, and I'm talking to my best friend right now. You don't get better than that, do you? It's Christopher Sturm.
Well, hey there, Mike.
How's
I never
you, bud?
I never get tired of those accolades. I don't know.
They're accolades. They count. It's kind of like it's the equivalent of, like, you know, if you're like last in a race at school and you get a sticker that says "I tried my best." It's like one of those accolades. Like it's a sort of false accolade.
It's like
it's a default accolade.
It's kind of like if, you know, someone is going for the same job as you.
Yeah.
And you get it.
Yeah.
Instead of them. And then you drive by their house every day at 8 a.m. and yell things.
Yeah.
Wait, that's not the same. That's different.
Hold I don't know what I mean. I used to work as a greenkeeper at Glen Eagles Golf Course when I was at university in the summer.
Really?
Yeah. And I had to drive an hour every morning to work. And it was like, I'd have to leave my house at like 4:30 in the morning and I would have to drive. And one day, and I drove through many little villages on the way. And one day my car horn broke about 5 minutes into the journey and it wouldn't turn off.
Mm-hmm.
So I drove for 55 minutes with my car horn on. And I was just driving through all these villages, just.
What time like, was this? What time?
It was like 5 in the morning.
Oh, so I mean, free wake up call. You don't have to pay for it. You don't have to remember to send it. Just boom.
One of the things that I do in my little group of chums that I have that all have the same affliction that I have is that it's encouraged to write a gratitude list.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a wonderful spin on what was a shitty situation. I should have gone, I was providing a service.
If that had happened to me, if I had been the one with the stuck horn and people were upset about it, I would be like, listen, how often in life does someone offer you a free wake up call at 5 a.m.?
Yep.
That's it. End of story. Moving on. We've moved on.
I'm not going to lie. I laughed solidly for about 50 minutes. Like, it was a very, very funny journey for me.
I mean, how could you not laugh? That's a ridiculous thing that happens and there's nothing you can do to fix it and you just have to laugh.
Speaking of ridiculous things that happened, Christopher has got a haircut.
We don't have to talk about it.
We have to talk about your haircut. So I would imagine what happened is that you went to go to a barber's. And instead, you went to an SS boot camp?
Christ. No. I went to a barber, and I told her that I wanted the sides short and the top longer with a fade, like a classic fade.
She's done it. I'm not going to lie.
Well, it's less of a fade and more of a skinhead on the sides of my head, and the top of my head is just a little bit of hair left. It's kind of cartoony. It's a really weird, I don't know. It'll look fine
full,
in a couple of weeks.
It's full Tommy Shelby from Peaky Blinders.
It is very, yeah. I'll here for the audience that are watching.
Oh, look at it.
There you go. It's very, if I went in and said, give me the Peaky Blinders and then I walked out with this, that would be considered. I think she did a really great job if that were the case. It wasn't the case. So maybe she just really was a fan and just was like, this guy's going to get the Peaky Blinders today.
It's like if someone said, have you ever seen a kitten sitting on top of a baked potato? Give me that.
I'll take that. I'll take that.
It's fine.
It's temporary. It's only for a couple of weeks that I'll be looking like this.
I had peroxide bleached hair for like 8 months. So
on purpose. No, that's true.
It wasn't that long. It's like 6 months.
It wasn't on purpose. It was fine. I think it worked fine. But for this is like, I got like this morning, I was like, should I just like shave the rest of it off to make it all one
full baked potato?
But then I would just be buzzed. Like really, it would be like pretty much bald. And I don't think I can do that to myself.
I just think that caps don't look right when you've done that to your hair. Like they don't. Yeah. I don't know.
You mean this right now?
On me, I mean.
Oh, yeah.
You look great.
Thank you.
As I'm sure you're aware, the Spooky Part Bench is all about professionalism, which is why we've recorded this ad separately for you to listen to while enjoying our wonderful, wonderful podcast. The Spooky Part Bench is sponsored by Newground Coffee, a roastery in Oxford that also happens to be a social enterprise, giving ex-offenders skills to work within the coffee industry and allowing them to thrive. If you'd like to try some of their coffee, which I highly, highly recommend you do, if you go to newgroundcoffee.com and enter Spooky20 at checkout, you'll get 20% off your first order. And back to the podcast.
How how's life apart from that? How's work? How's photography? How's taking pictures and stuff?
I worry that I'm going to jinx myself in some way by saying this, but I am realizing corporate life is not for me. Work-wise, I had a project last week that was a video project, which is my wheelhouse. I love doing video. But I told them what I needed to do this project, and they were like, nope, it has to be this time and this long, and the edit has to be done by this time. And I was like, is there a reason that these timelines are the way they are? And they didn't give a reason. I said, okay, so it sounds like these timelines are arbitrary, which I guess is not something you want to say to leadership, is that their timelines are arbitrary. So I got talking to the next day after that meeting, but I kind of lost my shit in that meeting. I was like, listen, like, I do this for a living. Like, this is like my wheelhouse. You should know that if you want this done properly, we need more time for this, and we need, you know, these things to work, you know, for this to work. And they were not interested in that. So it was very frustrating. Despite all odds, the project got finished and it got edited and it's okay. And it didn't go exactly as I planned, and it's not like perfect, but it doesn't, you know, doesn't need to be perfect. It just was not a pleasant experience. And it's just occurring to me that if I'm going to be okay and happy and, like, you know, survive working in a corporate photo studio, I have to just kind of smile and nod and just kind of deal with it. And it sucks, but, like, what are my options? Like, I can't throw my weight around, you know?
It's kind of the nature of, you know, working in photography in a professional capacity half the time. Like,
yeah,
you know, we're not, you know, rarely do we have the opportunity to sort of, you know, be like Dick Avedon or any of these people and sort of just get this creative freedom to go nuts. You know, we're always working under somebody, whether it's your client or whether it's your bosses. Like, you're always doing something for somebody else. They're hiring you often for your creative, you know, vision, but at the end of the day, you have to answer to somebody.
Yeah. And it's, I'm realizing it's like they hired me for my background, but they really want me to just execute rather than, like, conceptualize things. And it's funny because working in a corporate situation doing creative is a distillation of, like, all the experiences I've had, like having to deal with clients or deal with, you know, who I'm working with. And so it's just kind of funny. So I'm reckoning with that. Also, I'm not having a great time having to wake up every day and be at work at 8 a.m. and till 5. And it's just, I'm just tired already.
You're a night owl.
I am. I do a lot of my best work at night. I like to edit at night. And I have a lot of projects that I want to be working on that it's really hard to do when you have a 9-to-5. And so I'm kind of reckoning with, like, how do I get myself in a better routine in order to be creative outside of work? Because, you know, I'm kind of lucky that I get to be a photographer in my 9-to-5, but a lot of people, and I've heard this from people have asked me, like, how do you keep creative when you have work and you have to, like, work around, you know, putting food on the table and, like, making money, paying your bills. And I empathize with that so much because it's very difficult. And I think that's where a lot of frustration with, you know, creative pursuits, if you're a hobbyist, come from, because you don't have that institutional background where it's like you're getting paid to be creative. You have to be creative on your own time.
Yeah.
And it's really hard. So I'm reckoning with that now, but I'm finding that a good routine is kind of key. Like, having a routine is key. It's in how do you do that? How do you find that, you know?
Yep, I completely agree. And I fell totally out of love with photography because I was doing it as a job, you know? And
right.
It killed it for me. And partly that was my mindset at the time, you know? I wasn't being grateful for the fact I was getting to do it as a job.
Yeah, that's a big part.
it was me just huffing and puffing because I basically wasn't getting to do exactly what I wanted to do all the time. And I was sick of the admin, and I was sick of the chasing money, and I was sick of all of that. And, you know, then you go and spend a bit of time either walking in an office or going doing a job you don't really want to do. Well, I'm lucky right
now.
And then you realize. I'm lucky right now because I work in a job I love, but my photography work's starting to ramp up right now. And like, you know, it's happened quite quickly. You know, like big clients very quickly, which I wasn't expecting at all.
Good.
It was, you know, I said I was going to get back into it this year. And the last couple of weeks, a couple of big things have happened that I was not expecting. But, you know, it's come on the back of doing some stuff for free because I had connections.
Right.
I did some stuff for free because I was like, I know if I do this, then that gets my name out there again. And on the back of that, I've had calls for some really great work. And like, it's knowing when to make sacrifices. I could have stuck down to being like, I'm only going to do things for money because I'm a professional and this is what I need to do. But it's just not how this place works. It's using connections, you know?
It is. It is very much. I see a lot of things on social media where it's like, never work for free or never do this, never do that. Like, know your worth. And knowing your worth is very much different than not working for free, because knowing your worth is also knowing when to sacrifice or to make sacrifices or like make decisions that are going to pay off in the long term. So there's there's really no way to be like, this is the way to be successful. Like always saying like, I will not do it for this price or I will not go below this price. That's not the way that's going to guarantee success. Sometimes in certain markets, with certain people, yes, that can work, but everything is case by case. You have to read every situation specifically for what that situation is. And so for me, there have been jobs that I've taken that have been lower paying jobs, and they were done because like I knew the person or I knew the budget was low, but I liked the brand or I liked the people. So I wanted to offer my services because I believed in what they were doing and I knew they didn't have a budget, whatever. And then those I knew were okay to kind of like take that stance on because I knew that in the future that goodwill would go a long way towards jobs that would pay more and more opportunities.
Well, so like in the last 2 weeks, about a week and a half ago, so I went and did this work for a guy, Russell Norman, at a restaurant called Brutto. Now, Russell used to own Polpo, and he's a very well-known person in the food industry, especially in London. And I have known him. So I got in touch with him and I said, can I come and spend an afternoon shooting at the restaurant? And he was like, yeah, cool, of course. I think I said it on the podcast before, I had a strobe set up at one point while there was a busy lunch service going on.
Diners in the eyes.
Yeah, that wasn't that smart. But I got some good shots, you know. I did make a grave error on packing the night before, being like, I'm going to be all ready to go the next day. So I packed, you know, I packed my remotes so I could shoot long exposures and got my lenses all ready. And I got there, drove to London, which is about an hour and a bit from Oxford, drove into London, opened my camera bag and my lens, I'd switched. I hadn't realized I'd put one of my RB lenses in a bag that I usually put one of my Fuji lenses in. So I brought my RB lens and not my zoom lens. The only lens I had with me was an 85mm.
Wow. How did that work out?
Well, so Russell straight away was like, oh, do you want to get a shot of the outside? And I was like, yeah, I'm just going to stand about 100 meters back there.
Stand a block away.
But there was these gates. It was like down a little alley. And there was these like industrial gates and I had to get these gates open just so I could go into this car park, stand far enough back to get an exterior shot. And then when I was in, I just focused on details. And I was like, because also I think with restaurants, you're much better off getting a feel of the place as opposed to like full interior shots a lot of the time, little detail bits. So people, and like, you know, you shoot like a little bit of a banquette with a bit of a wall and a bit of a painting or whatever else. And then that gives you and then you can in post make it feel like it felt. So it was good. It was really good. Anyway, put those on Instagram. I've had a couple of emails from some, you know, I had an email from a 5-star hotel in Mayfair in London last week which was lovely. But I got this phone call out of the blue from this guy, and he was like, "I've got an Italian restaurant in Woking. I'd love you to come and photograph." And I was like, "Yeah, okay, cool." He said, "I've got two other restaurants, but we'll work together on this one, see how it goes." And I was like, "Okay, cool, that's fine." So we exchanged email addresses, gave my rates, and I forgot to ask him the name of the restaurant. So I emailed him and I was like, "What's the restaurant called?" And he said, "Oh, it's called Luciano's." So I was like, "Okay." So I Googled it, and he's Luciano Marco Pierre White. He's Marco Pierre White's son.
Oh, no kidding.
So I was like, "Oh, ooh, shit. Right. Okay." So I go and meet him last week, sit down, we're chatting, getting on well. And then his dad phones him. So he's on the phone with his dad and he comes back and he says, "How would you like a couple of nights away?" And I was like, "What do you mean?" And he was like, "Well, would you want to go to the Rudlow Arms, which is his dad's small exclusive hotel and restaurant?" Mm-hmm. He's like, "Spend a couple of days with my dad shooting that place, you know, in exchange for a couple of nights all inclusive." And I was like, "Yes." Because the only thing I said to him was, "Do I get to photograph your dad?" And he was like, "Yes." I was like, "Then yes." So that's an example of me going, work for free, then work for pay, but for somebody who's incredibly well connected to possibly the best known chef in the entire world. And I then get to go and photograph him for free. So then but not for free. I mean, if he'd said to me, "Do you want to go and stay at my dad's in exchange for payment for this job?" I would have said no. But I'll pay you for this job. We can then work together on further jobs and you can go and stay there and work for my dad. I'm like, that's a win.
That's perfect.
Like I weighed that up and I'm like, if I get to photograph Marco, like that's massive.
Well, the point I want to make off of what you did, which I think is a really important point and really important about what you did, was I've seen people who want to get work doing something, but they don't have any of that work in their portfolio, right? So if you, for instance, wanted to shoot restaurants, but you didn't have any good photos of restaurant interiors in your portfolio, why is anyone going to ask you to do that or try to get you to do that?
Exactly.
One of the things that I've noticed, my portfolio is pretty wide ranging. I have, food, restaurant, I have portraits, I have exterior and interior architecture, and I have e-com and on figure fashion. Because I have all that stuff, if someone looks at my portfolio, if they like one of those things and that's what they need photography for, they'll hit me up for it. But a lot of some of those things, before I got paid to do it, I went out and asked what you did. I said, "Hey, can I come to your restaurant and take some pictures? Cause I need some pictures for my portfolio, and then you can have them and use them. And then I'll use them for my portfolio and it'll be a win-win." And so the point I'm trying to make is if you want to get work doing a specific type of photography or creative, whatever you're into, you should go try to do that work first on your own without getting paid, because the only way you're going to get good at something and get noticed for being good at that thing is if you do it. And you're not going to get paid jobs out of nowhere just because you want to do it.
No.
You have to prove that you can do it.
And the other thing
and
is
that's what you did.
But I could have come at this another way. I could have come back at this and gone, I could have gone, right, I'm getting back into commercial, food and restaurant work. So, I've done it before. I've already had a name. I've worked for Waitrose. I've worked for this. I worked for that. I don't need to do this. But I'm not going to go to a fucking potential new client with no new portfolio and then no new vision and then go, "Can you hire me? I've not done anything for years, but can I have a job?" It doesn't work that way. So I knew I had to take a step back and go, I'm going to do some work for free using the connections I have from when I did work and get my name back out there again.
That's why my website's currently under construction. It's not down, but it's under construction right now. There's nothing up there. Because I had to realize that all this work that I shot is on my website's a couple years old. And if I want to get new clients that will look at my work and be like, "Oh, this is fresh and recent. Your work is good. Let's hire you." I have to go do more. And so that's what I'm working on now is I in the near future, when we move back to California or even when I'm still here in Milwaukee, I want to start taking on more clients for specific things. So I'm like, okay, now I need to go out there and do some of this work to prove that I can still do it, put it up have it be fresh new work, and then I can be like, hey, yeah, if you need this kind of work, like, here's my portfolio. And the biggest thing I can say around that, or the most important thing I can say around that for anyone in the industry, is just like, or who wants to be in the industry, just like, take your ego and toss it in the bin. Like, just don't, yeah, 100%. Don't have an ego, be humble, and be like, not having an ego doesn't mean that you take crap from people, or that you get shit on and then say, thanks, can I have some more? Like, no, like, that's different. Like, not having an ego basically means, like, what you did is, like, you could have said, yeah, I've already done this, like, just hire me. But instead you were like, you know, I got to show something new and fresh for new clients, and so I'm going to do that. And then you went and did it, and look where it got you. No ego.
Yeah. And, like, you know, it that's, I think, kind of the thing. And I mean, look, there's luck involved. There's who I know, you know, there's lots of stuff. Like, but I've also put myself in that position previously. So, like, I got to a position where I have these connections, you know. It's not like I'm some guy fresh off the boat. And also, I found with me that, like, I know, and I think this is a good lesson for anyone wanting to get into, is find what you're good at and drive at that. Like, mm-hmm. You can, it's important to be a bit diverse, like, when the doors are open, but even then, like, no, don't accept work you're not good at. Like, there is photography work that I do not do. I will just not do it because it's not something I'm good at. And even if the money was all right, I don't want to put my name to something that I will do a shit job of, because I will not get hired.
Well, that's the thing is people want to do something and they'll just, like, accept a job never having done it.
And there's lots, you know, there's glamorous photography work that people want, you know, that's what they think they want to do. And the reality might be that you're just not very good at it. And that's all right. Like,
and you know what? The glamour goes away the second you walk on set and realize you don't know what you're doing and you have to scramble to figure it out.
Yeah.
I've been there. It's not fun.
there's lots of different types of photography that I love and I love to look at, but it's not something I can pull off. I just don't do it, you know. Yeah. Anything that involves heavy editing, for instance, I don't do it because I don't have the skill set for it.
Same. Yeah. I, my point of view, I can do, like, an interesting point of view, like, my perspective on, like, a space or a thing, you know, maybe a creative direction that's different, like lighting, lensing, that kind of stuff. Like, yeah, I'm there. But if
anything
it has
that
to
involves
be like,
me shooting plates, and I don't mean plates of food, I mean, you know, sections of pictures to then, I don't, anyone that doesn't know that, plates are when you take extra images of the image to then use them in post to cover up. It's usually done with, like, glass and stuff more often than not, like mirrors and things and stuff like that. I don't do any of that shit because I can't do it. I can't do that in post.
I do it when I have someone editing for me, which I've been doing
then
more
I will.
Recently.
So sometimes
more
it'll
often
be like
than
the,
not, yeah.
Sometimes it'll be I'll shoot plates for the retoucher, but I'm the kind of photographer that I get 90% of it in camera.
Yeah. And that's how I work too. And I think there's there's merits to both ways. And I think there's places to use both, but yeah, I definitely like to get things.
Stick to your strengths. I think that's probably the main takeaway from that.
And to your point too, nepotism, like knowing people, having connections, like that's always going to be a thing always in any industry. It's always going to be about who you know, but you can control who you know, because like, for instance, you went to this restaurant, you made this relationship with this chef, took these photos. Now you know them. Now you're connected to that guy and who he knows. You took him pictures. He talks about you to other people, whatever. It's the same thing. If you want to know people and have connections in this industry to do more work, you got to do that legwork to meet and
immerse yourself in it
and be a value to those people as well. And it sucks because sometimes it feels like you have to demonstrate like a value to yourself, like not just – like, oh, me as a person, I'm not a value enough. But it's kind of true. If you want to be taken seriously in an industry, you have to demonstrate value and in that way make connections. And
I was guilty of in the past of, you know, especially with things like cookbooks and stuff. Like, I'd pick cookbooks off the shelves to look at the photography. And if I didn't like it, I'd be like, they're fucking shit. And I'd get, like, you know, resentments towards them and angry towards them. Like, how the fuck have they managed to get this? You know, they're shit and da da da.
Yeah.
Do you know why? Because they've done shit I wasn't willing to do. More often than not, I'm sitting on my arse going, you know, not putting the effort in and just pissing and moaning about somebody, getting work that I'm not getting because they were putting the effort in. They were doing the things you have to do to get those
some
jobs.
Of the people that you see who are doing like the most cool jobs you wish you were doing were just people who, like, talent or not, were just out there working their ass off, meeting people and making connections. And sometimes, as shitty as that is, like, sometimes that is what's going to make the difference. That's why social media is so hard.
Nobody's going to no one's going to just pop out of nowhere and be like, hey, I've heard you're a photographer. I've heard you're good. Do you want to come in? And also, like,
yeah, it doesn't
you know, sense. I knew that when I did this work for Brutto that it would go on their social media. So I know by going on their social media, the people I want to see it are going to see it. If I put it on my social media, these people wouldn't have seen it.
Right, right. And so that's also a good point too. If you're going to be doing work that is kind of for free in order to like get stuff in your portfolio for like some business or whatever, make sure up front you're very clear that they can only use your images if they are credited very clearly on social media, because that's actually a really big avenue. And a lot of photographers get screwed over and people will use their work and not credit them. And that happened to me once. I shot for the Claremont Hotel in Berkeley. Claremont Hotel is a famous hotel. And I took these beautiful images from the top. They gave us the penthouse for a day. We were up there like taking pictures and it was really fantastic. When they posted them on social media on Instagram, no tag, no mention of the photographer, no mention of photography at all, just the picture and then like some marketing blurb underneath. Yep. And every time I tried to reach out to them, it was just like radio silence. And it's because up front, I didn't say up front like, hey, if you're going to use these images, you must, you know, do this or I'm not going to, or we can't do it.
And I think that no one is going to come across my work on Instagram. Do you know what I mean? No one's just going to stumble upon it. Like,
and everyone right now needs to stop themselves from thinking that if they just post at the right time with the right caption and the right hashtags, that your work is going to be stumbled upon on Instagram, because it's just not. Things on Instagram that get noticed are because there's a built-in audience. And it took me a long time to recognize that, but that's what it is. You have to appeal to this audience. And sometimes appealing to them is just getting in front of their eyes. And sometimes that is not in your control.
That's it. Look, on the back of that, doing that job, I've had a PR agency get in touch with me wanting to use me as a photographer. Like, you know, like on the back of that. And that's all because I knew, and I am shit at social media. I don't use it much. I don't use hashtags. I don't really do any of that crap. But I knew that this guy's a big deal. He will share my images. People will then see it.
Yeah.
It was nothing to do with me sharing it or me doing the work. It was the end goal was getting them on his Instagram page. And that's what happened. And that's how it works from there.
Yeah. And that's the biggest kind of form of marketing you can do on Instagram. Do not spend money on Instagram ads. It just annoys people more than anything. And it's never going to go to the people you want it to. And the people it goes to that you want it to, they're not going to react to it the way you think they are. No one's going to look at Instagram ad and be like, oh, this photographer is amazing. Everyone's just going to think, oh, this guy bought Instagram ads. What an idiot.
Right. I quickly, as we went on here, went on our Instagram page and I put out on the stories, does anyone have any questions for us? Because we're recording right now.
Hey.
Rich Struffolino, who I always read his name and I always think of Snuffleupagus when I read his surname.
Rich Snuffleupagus, who is our good friend of the pod.
Yeah,
friend of ours.
His question is really deep. He says, am I going to install that update or what? He's clearly talking about the update at the top right corner of my screen, which, no, Rich, I'm not. I don't install updates on my computer ever because I can't be bothered with waiting for them to open.
That's
again.
His question?
That's his question. He's asking if I'm going to install the update on my. Tell you what, Rich, fuck you. Why don't you come and install my fucking update for me? There you go.
This is the kind of content you can expect from the Spooky Park Bench. Is there any other questions?
There is. Echo Lens, great question. In both of your opinions, what is the most underrated Deftones album?
Around the Fur.
Do you think that's... okay. Okay.
I mean, here's the thing.
I think it's Adrenaline, but...
You think Adrenaline is the
most underrated?
Why? That's not an accusatory why. I'm sorry. That sounded very like,
I think it's just overlooked. I think people just go from Around the Fur onwards. I think they don't think about like Engine Number 9.
I'll take, I agree. And that's why I'm going to change my answer. My answer is Saturday Night Wrist. And the reason for that is that album came out in 2006, right after I graduated high school. And by that time, Deftones were already well established. They were already veterans in the industry. They were already like a huge, White Pony was a massive album and everyone's favorite, of course.
Fucking masterpiece.
But yeah, Around the Fur was the first thing I heard from them. And then, you know, they're self-titled. And then when Saturday Night Wrist came out, a lot of people, it was originally panned by fans. People were like, this isn't that good or whatever. And Hole in the World, people looked at that song and were like, this isn't a very good Deftones song. I disagree. I think that song's great. And I think that that album is really great. And I think that people have come around now. I think a lot of people really love that album. But I think originally it was really underrated and underappreciated. And I think it's a fantastic album.
I kind of feel like anything sort of, I feel like everyone, when they think of Deftones, thinks of Around the Fur and White Pony.
Yeah, I agree. That's why Around the Fur was, I think White Pony gets overshadows Around the Fur, but Around the Fur, I would say, is still up in the high echelon of like releases.
Do you think that Be Quiet and Drive sounds like it should be on White Pony? Because I do.
Yeah, but that's because it's
that same sort of soundscapey kind of vibe.
Yeah,
I'd love to photograph Chino Moreno.
Welcome to the, I mean, take a number.
Not because I think he'd photograph particularly well, but just because I want to meet Chino Moreno. Actually, I want to meet Abe Cunningham because I think he's one of the best drummers ever.
That snare sound. We've talked about it on this podcast.
I know.
He defined a sound for drummers in the 2000s. Like, that was a sound.
Speaking of, I just gave a double finger click, finger point towards Christopher because I remembered something. So guys, this is massive news. I might have a new photography friend.
What? That's not,
you know,
me.
I've told you.
God damn, my allergies are killing me. I swear to God.
I phoned Christopher the other week, almost too giddy to talk about my potential.
Oh yeah, are you allowed to talk about this?
I can talk about it.
Did you talk to him yet?
I sent him an email and then he's not got back to me yet. But I was told that he was going to be, listen, I was told he's flaky. So he's seen my work. And do you know what he said? He said, I'm a real photographer. He was very impressed.
High marks from this guy.
My potential new photography friend who.
Is this going to maybe sour the relationship if he hears this?
What are the chances of him hearing this?
He's seen your work, so probably
high. Oh, shit, yes, good point. I'm going to do it. It's fine.
Okay.
My potential new photography friend is none other than bassist from Radiohead, Colin Greenwood.
Mm-hmm. When he told me, when you called me about it, you were relatively calm. I shat my pants. Because I was like, what?
I think I was in shock. I think I've been trying to process it.
Yeah. What's the story again? You met him.
I didn't realize that I know this woman who I knew she had an ex-husband who was in a band. Now, I didn't know which band he was in, obviously. And
but you recognized her and you Googled her, right?
Yeah. I thought I'm going to have to find out who this ex-husband is. And I did. Mm-hmm. And I Googled him and I Googled her and I was like, oh, shit. And then when I next saw her, I was like, I've got a horrible confession to make. I did some checking and I found out that your ex-husband is Colin Greenwood. And she was like, I want to talk to you about him, actually, because he's really into photography and he's just got a dark room and he doesn't really have, you know, many people that he talks to about photography. And I was wondering if I could give him your number. And I was just like...
So it's funny that you, even if you hadn't Googled her... She probably already was thinking like, oh, this guy's a photographer. My ex-husband, Colin Greenwood of Radiohead, is a photographer and wants to have more photographer friends. So I was already going to give you his number.
So all the guys from Radiohead live in Oxford. So they live here. And I've seen Tom York a couple of times and will never, ever, 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 ever approach him.
You will.
I can't. Unless
unless you're friends with best friends with Colin and they introduce
exactly. But yeah, so I might in the near future be hanging out with Colin Greenwood at his house in his dark room.
Humble brag.
Massive humble brag. I'm just
going to... There's a dark room in his house.
Yeah, I said to... Oh, it's funny actually, because when she came to speak to me a couple of days later at my work, just a random chat, Ben was there as well. And mm-hmm. Ben, friend of the pod, Benedict Campbell, he used to be a hand printer, a black and white hand printer. So he was like, I need to know what equipment he's got because... I need to make sure he's got the best dark room possible. And I was like, Ben, don't you try and get in on my friendship with Colin Greenwood.
I mean, he's doing what I would have done.
I know, asshole.
I would have done the same way. Just found a little way to worm in there.
I did say to her, I was like, can I talk about Radiohead? And she was like, yeah, he'll like that. And I was like, good, because that's all I'm going to talk about.
That's really funny. Are you going to tell him that I bought this microphone because of Tom York buying it? Or because Tom York used it, and that's...
I don't know if I should go straight in with talking about how great Tom York is, to be honest.
No. Don't do that. Yeah. But at some point after you've built a rapport, I would love for you to casually mention, oh, by the way, my best friend in the whole entire world out of 7 billion people, Christopher Sturm over in the US, he uses an RE20 because Tom York used it in the bass sessions, and he'll nail down it.
What my main goal from this friendship, apart from to become second best friends, because you're mm-hmm. my best friend, mm-hmm. with Colin Greenwood, is mm-hmm. to then have him on the podcast.
Right.
And we will talk about nothing but Radiohead.
And then we all become best friends with Colin Greenwood, and then we start a band, and Colin Greenwood plays in the band with us.
That's right. You play guitar, I play drums, mm-hmm. Greenwood
play
on bass.
Too. Yeah.
No, but you're mm-hmm. playing guitar in the band.
Sure. Yeah, I'll do that.
I think we should do it more like Mogwai-esque, no vocals.
Read my mind. I've been listening to Mr. Beast all week. Such a good record.
Yeah.
I love
Mogwai. I saw Mogwai in... I was still drinking then because I saw them and I was sitting... We were in seats and I fell asleep halfway through the second song and was asleep.
Because you were drunk or because they were boring?
I was drunk and fell and mm-hmm. was asleep through the entire gig. And I brought some new white shoes and I spilled my red wine all over them as well. So
you were
drinking
red wine?
Yeah. What? I mean...
At a concert? I don't dislike red wine, but it's such a weird choice for a live show to drink.
I'll tell
red
you why.
Wine.
Let me enlighten you why. I'm going to give you a little tip from an alcoholic.
Okay. Oh, God.
When you... go to something like a concert, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or like a theater trip or something like that.
Sure.
You can get a bottle of beer, right? Mm-hmm. You get a bottle of beer, you drink your bottle of beer in about 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Do you want another beer? Right. You've got to get back up, go all the way through, get another beer, come back down, sit down 10 minutes later. Fuck, I need another beer. Up, get down. Get a bottle of wine. Then okay. That's going to last you. Well, if you're not me, it's going to last you, you know, the majority
a
of the show.
While. Sure. Depending on the type of wine and what you're doing, how you're drinking.
I once walked out, I once went to the cinema on my own to go and see a James Bond film. Mm-hmm. And before I went in, I asked how many beers I could take in. And she was like, two. And I was like, right, okay. So I got my two beers and then I drank them before the film started. And then I was like, I'm too embarrassed to go back and ask for more beers, but I really want a beer. So I just left.
This has been a peer into alcoholism by Mike Sim.
I just left. I just went to the pub. I paid about £20 to watch some trailers.
I'm so glad that you're sober. I'm so glad that you're sober.
So am I.
So proud of you. Well, to switch gears a little bit, I actually wanted to talk about something that I found. So Nick Carver has his... workshops, which are great, and he has one about his metering system he developed, which is basically kind of a riff off of the zone system that Ansel Adams came up with, but it's like a way to do it that's like simpler, and it like allows, it's like whatever. I fully support Nick Carver, and I think if you really want a really deep dive into a really fantastic way to learn how to meter with a spot meter, it's been getting high praise. Friend of the pod, friend of the photo department, Aaron, Hellation Station on Discord. he took the course and he has nothing but good things to say about it. So if you like Nick Carver, if you want to learn things, go do that. But there's another resource I found for those of you who maybe would like to have a resource that's a book as well. I found this in a bookstore in Milwaukee last week for really cheap. It's the book number 2 in Ansel Adams' series of it's the negative, the dark, the print, and something else. There's like a 3-book series, but I found the negative, which is the middle book, and that talks all about metering, exposure, you know, film, mostly black and white. But it's this crazy informative tome, and it's dense, but if you can like get through it, if you want to read it, it's actually really, really cool. And it gives you some super smart insight onto how he was thinking about, you know, exposing things for film and how, because he wants to print them. So he wants to get a negative that's like good density, has a lot of detail, you know, and like he's very particular about like, you know, where light falls and talks about filters and everything. Really cool. So if you can find that book, The Negative by Ansel Adams, it's relatively inexpensive. And it's, I think every photographer who shoots film should have it because it's going to give you a really good insight. And that's my book report for this week.
Do you know, something like that is one of those things that like, I'll tell myself, like before I used to like, when I used to shoot, you know, everything, I was a natural light photographer. Yeah. Not because I didn't want to shoot strobe, but because I was scared of it and I didn't want to learn it. And like Ansel Adams books, it's the same kind of thing. Like I'm like,
I didn't wake off. What the hell?
It's empathy, mate. Okay. Right. Yeah, it's the same thing with Ansel Adams stuff. I've picked it up a few times and I've been like, I don't need this, but I know I would benefit from doing it. It's just, I can't be arsed reading it.
No one needs it. You can figure out the zone system or not. You can shoot photography the way you want. Know, I'm just saying if you, But if you are a photographer who likes to
why not learn?
Learn more and research and get better and try things, I think that I had a hard time with the zone system when I was learning it because it's kind of dense and heady and it's very like thought. You have to think, which
– Yeah. And if, you know
– I just want to point and shoot. Like why isn't the meter telling me what I need to
like,
do already?
For like street photography, it's great.
And for any photography, like if you want to know, if you want to know like, oh, I want the shadows to be in this zone because I want them to have detail. It'll tell you where your highlights are going to be, where your midtones are going to be. And you can really perfect and get exposure the right way every time. And it's kind of crazy. So anyway, either that or I'm saying two things, either buy that book or go take Nick Carver's course or do both. Nick Carver's course is more expensive, but I think he's a great teacher. And knows his shit.
See that? Look, this is a bloody, this is a positive podcast, this one. Do you want to end on one last question? It's a real deep, it's really deep too.
Oh God.
It's from Becca, aka the Oxford Doula. Mm-hmm. She has asked us, friend of the pod, she has asked us, lens cap, keep it on for safety or play it fast and loose?
Oh, that's deep a good question.
Once my lens cap comes off, it goes in my back pocket and it stays there.
I will say that there are specific situations when a lens cap is absolutely necessary. The main situation is when you have a camera like the Pentax K1000, because that camera, you can't turn the meter off. And if there's light coming into the lens, the meter's on and it's draining the battery. So if you don't want to drain the battery on your Pentax K1000, you got to put a cap on the lens. I didn't know that. And I told my girlfriend she didn't need a lens cap because I don't use lens caps ever. And I threw her lens cap away. her camera is constantly dying because she doesn't have a lens cap for it anymore. So I got to remedy that.
I've got to admit, when I got the X-T4, I was like, I was so precious, so, so precious. And now already my usual treatment of gear is starting to creep back in.
Yeah. Well, I will say that when I've damaged photography gear, I've never damaged the front element of a lens. I'll say the rear lens cap for the back, absolutely necessary. If I have a lens that's not on a camera, lens cap on the back goes on because the rear element is super important. It's closest to the sensor, so you don't want to damage it.
Yeah.
Same thing with a body cap. If a digital camera especially is not mounted with a lens, body cap on that bad boy. Front lens element, if you do scratch it or get a nick in it or have a little bit of dust on it, it's much too close for the lens to focus on. So worst case scenario, it'll be kind of dirty and it'll not look great. Best case scenario, it won't even notice it. So I would say keep the front of your lens element clean. And if you're not, I don't know. There's not really, like, if you're really worried about it, I don't think a lens cap is necessary. They're fiddly. Get a UV. Do you know if you really want that?
Do you know the people that always tell me about putting my lens cap on aren't photographers?
Yeah. Because if you're a photographer who's working, you know that, like, that little piece of plastic isn't really doing a lot.
I apologize, Becca. That wasn't a dig at you. It was a little bit.
It's a good question because I have photographers ask me that all the time too. Like, do you not put lens caps? I've had a photographer at my work. It's like, you don't put lens caps on your lenses. And I'm like, I mean, I'll do it to the ones here because I don't own them. And like, I don't want to hurt. I don't want them to get damaged in some way. But like my lenses, I've owned hundreds of lenses in my time and I've never injured the front lens element once. Basically, I'm not dropping lenses if my camera's
on or there's a lens on the body, generally the lens cap's off.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to be using it.
And with rangefinders, I don't know if you guys have seen my episode on the photo department where I go talk about Kodak Gold 800 versus Lomo 800 or 400. I don't remember which one it was. But my friend Hector out on the beach, he's got his Leica MP. He's got a shiny M6 and he has the fucking lens cap on his lens, but doesn't know it because the rangefinder. So if you have a rangefinder, you don't need a lens cap unless you hate yourself and want to have blank frames.
Exactly. That answers that question. Lens cap, get it off.
Get it out of there. If you want to protect the front lens element because you're shooting in a dusty place or you're shooting car stuff or just kicking up dirt or whatever, put a UV filter on the front that you don't mind getting damaged, a cheap one by B&W or Tiffin or something. And then if that gets damaged, you're fine because you didn't damage the front element. Get it off, get a new one.
I like a little bit of jeopardy on set, you know? I like a little bit of, you know, oh, this could be exciting. I might drop it. If I
can't potentially lose thousands of dollars in a moment's notice on a set, I don't want to be there.
You're right. That's just the kind of guys we are, though. That's why we just play it fast and loose.
That's why we're the successful men that we are. Can't even figure out how to hang out with each other.
Feast on my empire right now. This is it.
Yeah. Do you think a non-successful man would have this haircut? No. Mm-mm. Only successful men have Peaky Blinders haircuts that they didn't ask for.
Only successful men who are willing to sit there while someone destroys their head.
It'll grow back.
It's fine. It's only hair, isn't it?
It's only a couple of weeks and I'll be back to like sort of how it usually is. I'm not really that worried. I'm just
like peak
currently
sexy.
I look like.
No, do you know who you look like? Take this and enjoy it. You look like Brad Pitt in Fury.
I'll never look that good, but thank you. I appreciate you.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's better than a baked potato with a cat on its head. So
yeah, that one's going to stick. I feel it.
Listen, this has been a delightful, easy, fun, non-deep.
Wonderful.
We weren't angry once about anything.
Mm-mm.
Should we be angry about something before we go? No,
we'll save it for next episode.
I'm not sure what we're going to have on next, actually. I am quite enjoying the non-photographer element of it.
Yeah. I have some ideas, but we'll see. You know.
If anyone out there works in an industry that's in photography, like maybe if you're a clown or if you work in...
No clowns.
No, yeah, clowns are scary as shit.
But if you listen to the podcast and you have anyone who you think would be a good guest, feel free to DM us and let us know. We would love to hear your ideas.
Yeah. We still have dream guest Ed Templeton.
He was just on Analog Talk.
I know
two-parter.
He was.
Great.
And you know what happens? It goes Analog Talk, then us.
Oh, yeah. That's happened before. Comedy Tables, Analog Talk, then us.
Yeah. It happened with somebody else, too. It's happened a couple of times.
Ray Barbie.
Mm-hmm. Did it not also happen with Jason?
Yes, it did.
Right. So next up.
We get the runoff from Analog Talk. I hope they hear this.
The runoff is Ed Templeton, who's basically my idol, then I'm in.
That means Jason Lee's coming too. Hopefully we'll pick him up at some point. That'd be a
fun conversation. We're getting him. If we get Templeton, we get Jason Lee.
Yeah, I would say that if we approach Jason Lee with, hey, Ed Templeton was just on the pod, can we have you on the pod? He'd probably say yes.
I also want to get Jerry Sue on. These are the...
Oh my God. Can you... Dude, that would be such a great podcast.
So I've got Jerry's email address, his personal email address.
How? Don't tell me how.
Because I interviewed Ben Collin once, the photographer, skate photographer, and he's mm-hmm. friends with Jerry. And I was like,
Can we have Ben on too?
Yeah, we can get Ben on, 100%.
Let's get Ben on, and then we'll get Jerry on. I would love to have Jerry C. Wan. That guy is one of the cool, like, he was one of the guys I had a poster on my wall in high school.
He's my favorite skater of all time. I'll tell you, this is how cool Jerry Sue is. His email address is still a Hotmail email address.
Yeah, he's and it's those kind of dudes are the only people that make that cool still. Because if you're like a mom who still has a Hotmail email address, it's not cool anymore.
Yeah, Jerry Sue does
actually,
it. I'm just
moms
like,
are cool. Let's not disparage moms in May. It's Mother's Day coming up on the 8th. Moms are cool.
We've had Mother's Day here.
Really? You guys are that far ahead on the calendar.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me. Mine's dead. Thanks, man. Means a lot.
Oh, rip. Rip in peace. Fat rip on mom. Fat rip on mum. On that note,
here we go. We did manage to end on a bummer. Nice one.
That was a... I'm very sorry. I stand behind it. Mike,
you're not sorry.
Pleasure.
You didn't do it. It's fine. right. It's always a pleasure, man. I love you very much, and I will speak to you soon. Wow. To be honest, I'm going to speak to you as soon as I press stop on this.
Do we have to?
Yeah, I will. Right.
Okay, great. I can't wait.
Toodle pip, everyone.
Toodle pip.